Chihuahua. Mamá de Chihuahua.
More to do than can ever be done. There's far too much to take in here. More to find than can ever be found. But the sun rolling high through the sapphire sky keeps great and small on the endless round. It's the sun.
For listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Beatrix Hoffman talk about why the United States has been one of the few developed countries not to adopt universal health care and examines why the issue is so divisive.
My question, you almost answered it now, was about sort of individual resistance to healthcare, which I grew up in Germany, so it's very hard for me to understand why people, even if they have illnesses or you have family members who have chronic illnesses, why they are opposed to healthcare that actually would help them. And so that individual level among Americans is very hard for me to understand. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Well, in Germany, correct me if I'm wrong, and several other European countries, there's a principle of solidarity. Is that a word that rings true? And that has been very explicit in their political culture and is widely accepted, even, I think, among fairly conservative people, that when it comes to things like health, things that people have no control over, the principle of social solidarity takes precedence. And so people pay into a system so that everyone is covered. And it is true that individualism has been a very strong force against the acceptance of that idea of solidarity. I think it's important to know about the concept of solidarity because that helps make a little bit more nuanced all these arguments about, oh, all they do over there is socialism, because you know, there's a spectrum, and solidarity is a very mainstream concept in Europe, I believe. But that individualism, it leads to, you know, you might see the neighbor suffering, but maybe it's their fault. Maybe they are not eating right, or they're not exercising, or they've done something. And this is, I think, an example of the way individualism can shape the healthcare debate in this country. And that kind of takes form in the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act, which is not, again, an admission of solidarity or that we're all in this together. It's individuals' responsibility and obligation to purchase health insurance.
I'm Chris Shea, CEO of Derry Street Health Services, a federally qualified health center. We're a country of about 310 million people, and out of that, until very recently, about 55 or 60 million of those people did not have coverage. With the Affordable Care Act, that number will be down to about 30 million people or so. And if we fully implement the Affordable Care Act, that is, if all states choose to have the additional Medicaid coverage, we could be down to about 15 million who don't have coverage. That extension of Medicaid comes at very little cost to the states involved. The system is already set up in the Affordable Care Act to go into effect and to cover those costs if the states choose to move ahead with that. I find it inconceivable that we could deny 15 million more people coverage. And I also find it incredible that we are able to deceive people so much as to try to encourage them not to cover these additional people. Do you have any comments on that or how it might work out and so forth?
The Medicaid expansion? I do, and I would also love to talk just for a second about community health centers. So the Affordable Care Act was intended, as you said, to pretty drastically reduce the number of uninsured in the country through two different mechanisms. So instead of covering everybody, this kind of brings an image to mind of, instead of a sweeping coverage, you have coverage, so there's going to be employer coverage that people already have, and then there's going to be a segment of the uninsured who are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, so they will be subject to the individual mandate with subsidies to help them buy it. And then for the poor, and then up to 133% above the poverty level, which is a significant rise in the requirements for Medicaid, would be covered by this expansion. But as I mentioned, the expansion was not upheld by the Supreme Court last summer. So even though states can go ahead with it, still in the law, as you said, states are now able to opt out of it, and several of them have already done so. Texas being one of them, saying we don't want this money, even though it's free money for the first several years for the states from the federal government. So they're saying the states that are refusing this are saying, well, it's going to be too expensive in the long run. But it's hard to imagine that there's not some sort of ideological component to their refusal, because it is kind of a no-brainer. It is a cheap way of covering a lot more people. And so now, instead of having, I meant to conclude that with, there's still going to be a gap there, after these new types of coverage. So now we're going to have this, but then the Medicaid coverage is going to go way down, so that gap is going to be that much bigger. And I didn't mention the provisions for community health centers in the law. Is your center going to be affected at all? There is a lot more money for these types of community-based clinics now. Do you have anything to add? I was just curious how it's affecting you.
Well, it's already allowed us to expand our services considerably with a couple of new clinics, including one that's opening up Monday. So I think one of the other issues besides coverage is the fact that you can have a card, you can have a Medicaid card, for example, but if there aren't enough enough places that accept Medicaid coverage, you still don't get care. So this is a provision of the Act that allows community health centers and other preventive oriented agencies to open their doors a little bit further so that you can use that coverage.
Great. Thanks.
We have time for one more question over here, and then I just want to remind people that we have Beatrix's books for sale outside, and we have a next panel to get onto, so I'm going to just come right up here for our last question.
So I had a question about the women activists and whether you just chose women activists because it's women and gender historians of the Midwest, or are women in the vanguard of this kind of pushing back against what they perceive to be inequitable treatment? And if so, why or why not?
I guess they have been. I didn't do it on purpose. They came to me from the historical record. When I wrote my first book on the Progressive Era Health Reform, you know, I did expect to be writing a lot about Teddy Roosevelt, and he's in there, but it was these women, garment workers and union organizers in New York City who were really, they were starting their own community health clinics in New York, and they didn't use the language of rights at the time, but they definitely talked in terms of universalism and that everybody should have access to care, not just those who are unionized, those who are members of unions. And is there a gender component to that? Does their gender make them more in the vanguard? In some ways, I think there are some connections. The maternity insurance issue has always been a big one. So I think a lot of these critiques of the American way of rationing have been rooted in women's experiences with health care and the health care needs that women have. So maternity coverage, coverage care for children was the impetus behind the Sheppard-Towner Act in the 1920s, of Public Health Act. And, of course, the movement for reproductive rights has, at times, I wish more attention were paid to this because it has done this, but we hear much less about how reproductive rights activism is also about health care for all, for everybody. There's so much focus on, you know, women are demanding these particular reproductive services, but I think that those types of activism, again, rooted in experiences, have led to a really strong stand on behalf of universalism and health care rights, even though not all women activists would define that the same way.
So we're going to have to stop there.
Thank you so much.
For more information, visit the author's website, BeatrixHoffman.com.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on AccessSacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Good evening. I am a reporter for Al Jazeera, the Arab News Network. And I am here this evening to dispel the ugly rumors that our broadcast contains secret messages intended for terrorists. That is not true. Our broadcasts are straight, just like your Fox TV. No. It's not true. We Arabs, we love your people. We love the USA. It is true. Actually, I have a little song to sing for you that will prove that. But first, I'd like to introduce my special assistant, Falala Smith. That's her married name. Yes, she is the winner of the Al Jazeera Wet Burqa Contest. She has a lovely figure. Trust me on this. All right, shall we begin? Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, love the USA. You sing along with me now. Yes, you know this tune, huh? It's old Arab tune. Here we go. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, loves the USA. Afghan president is calm. Hope we don't see Karzai bomb. Karzai bomb, Karzai bomb. Oh, sing along. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the president.
We're in Cuban prison cells, locked in yours, not infidels. Infidels! Gutter side bomb! Here we go again! Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera loves the USA. Arab views are not so mean. That's how views in Gaza lean. In gasoline, infidels, Karzai bomb. Here we go again. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera loves the USA. For Iraq's rebuilding path, pick a leader. Take a bath. Take a bath in gasoline. Infidels, Karzai bomb. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera loves the USA. Salam, salam, salam.
Coming up next, alternate economics. Professor Manuel Castell says the current financial crisis is more than just an economic downturn. The causes are so deep-rooted that they have provoked a profound reassessment of our economic beliefs and institutions and have given rise to a new economics.
In this week's analysis, Paul Mason talks to the internationally renowned sociologist Professor Manuel Castells about the financial crisis and the new networks of solidarity and protest it's inspired in a special programme recorded at the London School of Economics.
Good evening and welcome to the London School of Economics. I'm Paul Mason, and tonight, in front of a huge audience, about 800 people here, I'll be speaking to Professor Manuel Castells. Professor Castells is one of the most cited sociologists in the world, and it's easy to see why. He is University Professor and Wallace Annenberg Chair in Communication, Technology and Society at the University of Southern California. When most of us were still struggling to connect our modems in the 1990s, Professor Castells was documenting the rise of the network society. When the sociology of protest was still dominated by political parties, trade unions and men, Castells was theorising what he calls the power of identity, studying the interaction between internet use, counterculture, urban protest movements and the self. When these two phenomena, protest and the network, came together in mass social movements during the Arab Spring and with the Occupy movements, Castells was already on the case. In fact, the professor, in his own small way, he tells us in his book, was part of it. In his latest book, Aftermath, The Cultures of the Economic Crisis, which he's edited and co-authored with a team of academics, the professor shows us a picture of an economic crisis that has produced a social crisis. He suggests we may be about to see the emergence of a new kind of capitalism with business models growing out of the countercultures of the last 20 years becoming much more mainstream. Ladies and gentlemen, Manuel Castells.
Thank you, ladies.
In your book, Aftermath, you speak of the emergence of a kind of four-layer economy post-crisis. So it's with a weakened public sector, a highly concentrated, successful private sector in the high-tech and financial arenas, what you describe as the survival models of traditional businesses, and then at the bottom, this fascinating new layer of post-capitalist, alternative economic activities. How long can that survive?
Well, it's expanding, as a matter of fact. What I refer to is about the observation of one of my latest studies on people who have decided not to wait for the revolution to start living differently, meaning the expansion of what I call a technical term, non-capitalist practices, meaning they are economic practices, but they don't have a for-profit motivation, such as barter networks, such as social currencies, cooperatives, self-management, agricultural networks, helping each other simply in terms of wanting to be together, networks of providing services for free to others in the expectation that someone also will provide to you. All this exists and is expanding throughout the world.
That's expanding. But just let's stay on the whole economic system, including the public, the private, the beleaguered traditional sector. Where do you think that is currently going? Because it's not in stasis, it's in crisis. So where is it going?
You see, the issue, when I mentioned this alternative economic culture, it's a combination of two things. A number of people have been doing this for quite a while already because they don't agree with the meaninglessness of their lives. But now there is something else. It's the legion of consumers who cannot consume. And therefore, since they do not consume, they don't have the money, they don't have the credit, they don't have anything, then they try at least to make sense of their lives doing something different. So it's at the same time the because of needs and because of values, the two things together, that way it's expanding. And this has been in the third world for a long time, but it's different. It was survival waiting to be integrated in the system. But this is a massive pull out from the system. And it's not the same thing than the social movements. It's something different.
It's something different, and let's be clear about that. When we see, as I've seen in my work, whole blocks of flats in Seville in Spain, occupied by very poor marginalised people, led by activists from the M15 Occupy movement, that is what you're talking about. It's the expansion of that you think is crucial to the current stage.
This is the most visible part. But what is much more interesting for me is the diffusion of this kind of practices in large segments of the population. We have measured that in the case of Barcelona. It's about 25% of the population of Barcelona. But Los Angeles, New York, we are seeing it at the same time.
You write that the current crisis is effectively cultural. You write the economy is, all economies are, culture. Can you just expand that?
If we want to work to make money, to consume, it's because we believe that by buying a new car or by buying a new television or a bigger flat, we are going to be happier. This is a particular form of culture. If, on the contrary, we say, what is really important for me? Well, for most people, what is important, statistically speaking, is love. That's the most important thing for people. But love needs time, you know? You cannot make love running between two things, and even less fall in love. That's why one of the most successful businesses in the world now is matching people through computers, because they don't have time to meet. So people are reversing, many people are reversing the notion that what is important in their life cannot be bought in most cases. But they don't have the choice anymore because they're already trapped in a machine. What happened? When the machine is not working anymore, people say, well, I'm really stupid. I'm running all the time for nonsense. And in addition, they don't even pay me and they fire me.
So the implication of that would be that if we're seeing large numbers of people hit that barrier in Western society, in consumer-based Western capitalism, and they are in increasing numbers, as phoned by you, switching off from that and switching on to something else, how big a change is this? Because, I mean, the collapse of feudalism was essentially caused by a series of moments like that, a series of this no longer works, I'm going to change my values. How big is this culture change? Could it be fundamental?
It is fundamental because it triggers a crisis of trust in the two big powers of our world, the political system and the financial system. People don't trust where they put their money, and they don't trust those who they delegate in terms of their votes. All the statistics are there. It's a dramatic crisis of trust. And if there is no trust, there is no society. It's simply institutions that they still try to control citizens. But the main thing is the acceptance in their minds, because nothing else is possible. So what we're not going to see is an economic collapse that per se, because societies cannot work in a social vacuum. If the economics institutions don't work, if the financial institutions don't work, the power relationship that exists in society change the financial system in ways favor to the financial system. And it doesn't collapse. People collapse, not the financial system. Then people realize two things. First, this financial system was built on completely unreliable mathematical models, in fact, with the implication that we don't count there. Second, when we use the institutions that we have to control the financial system, to change it, to re-equilibrate it, the notion is the banks are going to be all right, we are not going to be all right.
I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free, a diversified multicultural postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced, I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message, and off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top, but under the radar. A high-concept, low-profile, medium-range ballistic missionary. A streetwise smart bomb. A top gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties. I tell power lies. I take power naps. I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach. A raging workaholic. A working rageaholic. Out of rehab and in denial. I got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, a personal assistant, and a personal agenda. You can't shut me up. You can't dumb me down, because I'm tireless and I'm wireless. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers. I'm a non-believer. I'm an overachiever, laid back and fashion forward. Up front, down home, low rent, high maintenance. I'm supersized, long-lasting, high-definition, fast-acting, oven-ready, and built to last. A hands-on, foot-loose, knee-jerk head case, prematurely post-traumatic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. But I'm feeling, I'm caring, I'm healing, I'm sharing. A supportive, bonding, nurturing primary caregiver. My output is down, but my income is up. I take a short position on the long bond, and my revenue stream has its own cash flow. I read junk mail, I eat junk food, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I'm gender-specific, capital-intensive, user-friendly, and lactose-intolerant. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory-authorized, hospital-tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, and vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cocked, locked, and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow. I go with the flow. I ride with the tide. I got glide in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road. I party hardy, and lunchtime is crunch time. I'm hanging in, there ain't no doubt, and I'm hanging tough, over and out.
And now for something completely different.